Daniel Kahn, thanks so much for joining me to be on Ingeveb's website.
Oh, it's a Vergnügen.
So can you tell me a little bit about, just in general, your musical life right now?
Well, as I like to say, I'm more everywhere than anywhere. I'm on the road a lot. You know, I live in Berlin, but I'm here quite a bit. I've just been traveling a lot, you know. And whereas a couple of years ago, it would have been more with my band, you know, like playing sort of the same program with the same guys. It's been very diverse. Like I'm doing a lot of different projects right now. I'm involved a lot in theater, in both in Berlin and now in New York, and in different capacities. And I have other musical projects, the Brothers Nazarov and duo projects and solo shows and workshops and different programs.
So is all of what you're doing still within the Yiddish Jewish world, or is it sort of outside of that too?
Very little of what I've done has ever been exclusively within the Jewish cultural world. I try as much as possible to bring, you know, the work that I do that has specific Jewish cultural content into contexts that are not exclusively Jewish. The same way the expressly or specifically Jewish cultural circles that I move in, I feel like they're at their most vibrant when artists and creative individuals are bringing in what they bring from other worlds into that world. I don't really believe in hermetically sealed cultures. So, yeah, there's definitely a Jewish cultural component to a lot of what I do. Most, I would even say. I mean, there are certainly shows that I play that have nothing to do with it whatsoever, but it's a part of me and it's a part of my interest, so I bring that to it. And what turns me on the most is when these worlds come into conversation with each other, when there are unexpected, you know, resonances between people who otherwise would have nothing to do with one another in a kind of strict cultural way.
So in that vein, who are your biggest musical, theatrical, cultural influences?
Wow. Well, to make that list is like the story of my, you know, to go all the way back. I mean, within this world of like the Yiddish culture movement world, there's certainly, you know, my elder friends and mentors, like who are also who I'm lucky enough to call my colleagues, who are both those who are with us and who have passed on, you know, people like Michael Alpert, people like Adrian Cooper, Olive Sholem, people like Alan Byrne and Lauren Sklamberg, and you know, these are my friends and my teachers, you know, who inspired me in this world. You know, on Thursday I'm going to be at a benefit honoring Theo Bakel, who I have the honor of knowing, and I just got his book here, Folk Songs and Footnotes by Theodore Bakel. I mean, he's definitely a huge influence and inspiration to me. But, you know, then the people who made me want to be an artist, you know. Well, there's one of them right here in the hospital that we're sitting in right now, you know. His name is Saul Frieder. He's 95 years old. He was born in 1919 in Stuttgart. His parents were Polish. He grew up as a German, a Jew in Germany, you know. And he was friends with Lotte Lenya. His brother was in the original Three Penny Opera. He and all of his siblings, unfortunately not his parents, survived the war. And he came to America in the 1950s, here to New York, and became an actor and worked on Broadway and worked in film and was in a lot of Woody Allen movies. And when I was 12 years old, I was cast in my first professional play in Detroit, and Saul was in that production, and we've done a few plays together, and he became like a kind of surrogate grandfather for me. I never had a grandfather that I knew. So every time I would be in New York, ever since I was 12 years old, I would always visit him. And we would play chess and talk. And, you know, he was one of the first people in my life who really showed me that one can live a long, fulfilling, adventurous life as an artist, you know, the life of the mind. These are the mentors and inspirations whom I knew personally, you know. Then there's other people like, I don't know, Nina Simone and Utah Phillips and Tom Waits and Leonard Cohen, who are, you know, different kinds of inspiration for me.
It sounds like theater was sort of your first love, or at least it was the first performance that you did professionally. So mm-hmm. how does theater affect your music, and how does your music affect your theatrical performances currently?
I see it as one thing. I mean, it's a different way of organizing time, and certainly it's a different mode of listening for the audience. But for me, they're just different forms of storytelling. I mean, I studied acting, and then I studied directing and writing. And pretty much the day after I graduated, having studied those things and having worked in the theater at that point for 10 years professionally, I decided that I just wanted to be a songwriter and sing folk songs and write songs. And I wrote and wrote and wrote, and I formed a folk music collective in Michigan called Earthwork with several friends. And I moved to New Orleans, and I became a songwriter, and I made several solo records, and that became my life. And I would still do theater projects once in a while, but I didn't rely on the theater industry as a way of making a living. I don't really like theater as an industry. I don't really like music as an industry. I don't really like industries. They're not really my thing. I like communities. I like public conversations. I'm not a very good businessman. So getting into songwriting, it was really a way for me to be playwright and actor and director all at the same time, in a very satisfactory way, you know, that I could create a song and immediately start performing it and immediately get responses from people and immediately, you know, communicate feelings or ideas. That still plays a big role in my work in the theater, although I still enjoy doing theater that's not musical. I just directed a play with a script that I adapted with my partner in Berlin. I'll be acting in a play in Yiddish, actually, in the fall. That's the new Yiddish rep. They're doing Death of a Salesman, and they asked me to play Biff. So I'm pretty excited about that. It's a big honor.
Ich bin a Fremel, der Feigster Marwiche, a größer Künstler, harbet leicht und sicher. Das erste Mal, welches Gedenken wissen deut, ach ein Entwiese verlachen in a Bräut, oi, oi, vor nicht auf
mein... So when did you learn Yiddish?
I took the Yiddish summer program in 2008 at YIVO. I had already been learning it at that point for about 4 years, sometimes informally, sometimes formally. One of my teachers, Olive Shalom, was Pesach Fishman, and learning through songs and learning from other singers. Songs are a great way to learn a language, and I was pretty much, I started with Yiddish a bit before German, but I was pretty much learning them simultaneously. I didn't speak German before I moved to Berlin. And I picked up German really quickly, and I was picking up Yiddish at the same time. And I just kind of developed them in two different compartments in my mouth. For me, they help each other. And it helps to be living in a Germanic-speaking country.
For you, is Yiddish contained within performance, musical, theatrical, or otherwise? Or do you speak Yiddish in your daily life? Or do you use Yiddish other than to perform in it?
I try to. I don't make an effort to pepper my English or German speech with little Yiddishisms. I don't really... I mean, it happens, of course, you know, because Yiddish is a wonderful source of great, you know... Chachmas, but I try to use Yiddish when I can with Yiddish speakers, and I certainly have Yiddish speaking friends, and we speak Yiddish with each other when we can. Sometimes we don't, sometimes we use it as a secretive language. But for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I was in the Eifel of all places, which is a beautiful mountainous region of Western Germany. Really, these really dramatic mountains covered in lush evergreens, they're volcanic hills. And of all places, there is a fairly vibrant klezmer festival there. attended by almost entirely non-Jews, except for a couple of the people who were teaching, who were also a minority of the teachers. And I think that's okay. I think that klezmer is a German folk music now, regardless of whatever life Eastern European Jewish music had in Germany before the war or whatever, which is very complicated history. It's a German folk music now because it's a music that Germans play, and they've been playing it for 40 years on a popular level within certain niches. And they have their own way of playing it, and they're mostly not Jews, and that doesn't matter at all. It's their music to do whatever they want with. You know, I'm not going to tell Keith Richards to not play the blues, and I'm not going to tell some German to not play klezmer music. Some of them engage in a very creative and deep way with it. Some of them don't, but a lot of Jews don't either. Anyway.
Do you think people would disagree with you that it's a German folk music
now? Of course they would, but I'm not interested in that. Like, this is my opinion. I've lived there for 10 years. I play music with a lot of Jews and non-Jews, Germans, non-Germans, and it's part of the cultural fabric of contemporary multicultural Europe. It's part of the musical fabric of contemporary multicultural Europe, and Germany has been an important epicenter for modern, contemporary, forward-looking, but, you know, traditionally grounded and informed Yiddish culture for the last 40 years. And so people can take issue with me, and, you know, and they do, and I don't give a shit. So anyway, what I was saying was, there I was in this town, and there was a woman there who was a guest of this festival, who was brought there by a woman, a Yiddish singer. The Yiddish singer's a German. She's non-Jewish. She's been going to Vilnius for the last 20 years and has engaged in a deep historical way with the history of the Vilna ghetto and the history of Vilna. And she brought with her this time a friend of hers, who's a 93-year-old woman from Vilna. She was a partisan. She was in the ghetto. She is a Yiddish teacher. She started a Yiddish gymnasium there. She speaks a beautiful Litvish, and she's 93 years old. She's tough as nails. She lives on the fourth floor of a building without a lift. And it was just a joy. And for 4 days, I just hung out with this woman, and she's so charming. And she's great. Her name is Fania, and we just talked Yiddish all day long. And it was such a joy to be able to speak Yiddish with somebody and just to get to know her, you know, not as some sort of a museum piece of a lost, you know, culture or anything like that. It's just like that's her language, and it was great to be able to speak to her and get to know her and joke and you know, hear these great stories. I mean, she knew Shmeka Kachaginsky, and she knew people who knew all of these, you know, people like Avram Sutzkever and you know, these amazing partisans. You know, I could sing a song with her, like Still die Nacht ist ausgesternt, and she knew the woman that it was written about. You know, that world is not so far away. Rachel Kefirson wrote an interesting article the other day about this idea that, like, the Yiddish Eastern European past is like this nebulous kind of netherworld, this lost, she calls it the Atlantis, you know, like Yiddish and Jewish Atlantis, you know, that it's behind the veil, the Holocaust and, you know, 20th century and everything, but it's really, it's not that long ago. Yeah, a lot of the people who lived in that world are passing on, you know, but it's not like they had no effect on us. They left us a lot. We have a lot to work with. We have a lot of work to do.
So it seems like you're doing some of that work. You've undertaken a lot of mining older material and bringing it to a new audience and setting it to new music, creating instrumentation that's new, all of that. So what's your favorite example of that and something that you've done?
Well, okay, like I just mentioned Avram Sutzkever, you know, like Sutzkever was a, you know, he just died 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and he, but he wrote, I don't know, there's a poem that he wrote in February of 43, called Viazoy, which he wrote in the Vilna ghetto, and I don't know, some years ago I set it to music and I translated it into English, and it became a song that I perform, and it's a song which is, it's really dark. It's a really, really dark poem.
Viazoy, und mit was wirst du fühlen dein Becher in Tag von Befreiung Bist du gerät in dein Fred Zedarfilm? Dein Vergangenheit, finstere Schreiung, wo es glivern Scharbens von Teg, in Atom, ohne Grund, ohne Deck, wo es glivern Scharbens von Teg, in Atom, ohne Grund.
It's about the impossibility of liberation in a very in any kind of like simplistic way. This is before the liberation, but he imagines the liberation, and he imagines it as something which is unliberating because of just the depth of the horror. He says, "Bist du bereit in dein Fred zu der vielen dein Vergangenheits finstere Schreiung?" Are you ready in your joy to truly feel yesterday's dark screaming, you know? And yesterday is also a play on words. He says, dein Vergangenheit, your pasts. So the past is die Vergangenheit. Kate is a chain, so he makes a little bit of a play on words. It's also an alternative suffix to height, Kate, you know? You speak Yiddish, so that's it. Vergangenheit. The chain of the past, your past chain. And actually, when I originally translated the song, I didn't even catch that. Somebody pointed it out to me years later. And then I wrote a whole article about just this one phrase. But that's an example of a song which I think has a lot to say to the world today. A lot, not only about how horrible it was in the Vilna ghetto, because it's not, I mean, it was written in a specific circumstance, but we can certainly find ways in which it's relevant. You know, there are plenty of people who are in need of liberation today, of one kind or another. And I think that there's a great deal that one can draw from this, from the insight. It's a really nihilistic, you know, it's a dark insight, but it's finding solidarity in nihilism is comforting.
As you chew on the sidewalk like bread, and the time gnaws you silent and dumb, like a cricket held inside your fist. And the time held you silent and numb, like a cricket held inside a fist.
What does making it new add to it?
I don't know if it adds anything to it. I think that it has something to add to the new. I think that it has something to offer to the world today. I think that by bringing this older material into a contemporary context, it helps us understand our context better. It's really about the present and the future. And the past is only interesting me insofar as I'm interested in the alternative futures of the past, which were rendered moot. You know, I'm interested in what could have happened, you know, where things might have gone, not only what did happen. We know a lot about what did happen. We don't know enough about what didn't happen, you know. Yiddish songs are a great way of looking at that because they're full of dreams. Folk songs in general are. If the songs were durable enough to survive, to reach us, there must have been some durable dreams buried in there.
You talked about how you take a Yiddish, you'll take a Yiddish song, you'll translate it, you'll set that to music, but oftentimes you use more than one language in a song.
Right.
So what's the choice behind that?
Well, my first sort of contact, well, not my very first contact, but my first sort of entrance to Yiddish was translating songs. And it's still, you know, it's something that actually Theo Bekel is great at, you know, and I love his translations. He translates also into a rhyming, singable English, you know. And I'm sort of against the exotic. I don't really like exotification at all. I'm not interested in anything remaining in a field where it can't be understood. I appreciate the emotional level on which people are touched by music, regardless of the content, but maybe I'm just a bit of a, maybe, yeah, I like stories and I like actual content. I like to know what things are about. I love poetry. I love I love epic poems and, you know, ballads, long ballads, you know. And, you know, I remember one of the first songs I ever translated, probably I think it was the second song I ever really translated, was Mein Ruheplatz by Moritz Rosenfeld, which is, when I first heard it, it was at Yiddish Summer Weimar, and Tamara Brooks, who was Theo Bekel's partner, who passed on, she was conducting a choir, and they were singing Mein Ruheplatz, and it sounded so beautiful. And it was not the wrong way to perform that song. It's often performed chorally. It's a plaintive song. There was a sadness to it, but I didn't understand the text. And then I sat down with the lyrics and I looked at them and I saw how heavy they were. And that there was an anger behind there. There was a sense of injustice. I mean, it's a sweatshop poem, you know? And I certainly knew American folk songs that had the same mixture of the same, like, mournful anger, you know, in some of the Union songs that I knew, and some of the songs of struggle, songs like Hard Times Come Again No More, or songs by Woody Guthrie. And so when I read the lyrics, I realized, wow, there has to be a way to be able to perform this song where I can find out what it's actually about, and also hear the poetry of the Yiddish without resorting to this thing of like speaking a translation and then singing the Yiddish, which alienates the song, because it for me, that's like a kind of a putting a label on something in a museum, you know, like these little captions, you know. There's a wonderful Cy Twombly painting, which is a painting of people in a gallery where there's like a giant painting and then all of these people, and they're just like bent over staring at this tiny little tag. I thought that was very funny. And I think that songs can be very much the same way. I wanted to find a way of performing these old songs and performing them in a way that was sort of my own and fresh. And so my approach to it was to approach these songs as a songwriter and to try to find a way of rewriting the song in my original English. While being faithful to the gesture of the song and the emotional movement of the song and then the structure of the song, but not being slavishly faithful to each image or rhyme to sort of, translate what the song itself was a translation of.
Such mich die Myrten grinnen, gefinst mich dort nicht mein Schatz, wo Lebenswelken beim Schienen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Nicht such mich hoch, die Vögel singen, gefinst mich dort nicht mein Schatz. Als Sklav bin ich, wo Ketten klingen, dort ist mein Ruheplatz, dort ist mein Ruheplatz. Look not for me in nature's greenery, you will not find me there, I fear, where lives are wasted by machinery. That is where I rest, my dear. Look not for me where birds are singing and chanting songs. Find not my ear, for in my slavery chains are ringing. Is the music I do hear, nor where the streams of life are flowing. I draw not from these fountains clear, but where we reap what greed is sowing. Hungry teeth and falling tears,
I started writing these songs and translating, adapting, tradapting, I call it. I thought I invented the word tradaptation, but apparently it's a theater term already. So translation, adaptation. And then, yeah, that sort of became my MO. I don't always do it, and I have different strategies. And I like the idea of singing in more than one language. I think it's interesting what happens to the brain when a singer flips. And I do it in the theater also a lot, you know, flipping in the middle of a line sometimes. I just wrote this play that's half in Yiddish, half in German, and some of the lines will just switch in the middle. And it's not like using Yiddish-inflected German or anything like that, or Germanized Yiddish that a German audience can understand. It's more like really just flipping, you know. And I've been doing it between English and German as well a lot in songs and in theater. And I think that's okay. I mean, I also happen to live in a city where that type of switching is just absolutely normal, whether it's between English and German, which it is for a lot of Berlin, or between German and Turkish, which it is for a lot of Berlin. I know people who switch between three or four languages within the space of two sentences. You know, I'll hear people and they'll switch between Turkish, Arabic, German, and English within a sentence in my neighborhood, you know. And this is, of course, nothing new with Yiddish. Yiddish itself is a language that can do that within it, within Yiddish, you know. It can switch from a more Hebraic Yiddish or more Slavic Yiddish or more German Yiddish, you know.
I find it interesting that you said you like the way the brain flips as the singer, you know, switching between English and German or German and Yiddish or English and Yiddish, but mm-hmm. like as the listener too, your brain switches, or it doesn't, you know, if you're facile in both, then.
Yeah, well, there is a switching there, but I mean, yeah, I mean, I think I'm totally equally interested in what effect that has on a listener and, you know, what it means when all of a sudden you realize that this thing that you've been listening to that functions purely sonically or musically, when it becomes something that you can understand. And sometimes when I perform, I work a lot with Psoy Korolenko, as you know, from Moscow, and he and I will be singing a song in Yiddish, English, Russian. And Pasha Psoy calls it spell art, which is like when people hear a language that they don't understand at all, then it functions like a spell. And so singing in three languages, there will always be one language that's like spell art, one language that is understood, and one language that is sort of half understood, or often this is the case. So I think that the brain does interesting things switching between languages like that. And switching, especially, I mean, we talk about verfremdungsklezmer being a kind of like alienation effect with klezmer, and like trying to challenge people's assumptions and their expectations from a certain cultural material and whatever they think about certain things. And one way of doing that is by surprising people with the fact that they can understand something and that it can't remain exotic.
So what is the painted bird of your band name?
Oh, we stole it from Jerzy Kosinski, this novel from the 60s. I don't know, I guess I have a weird thing about, like, 60s Holocaust novels, because I just did a play based on a Romain Gary book from the 60s called The Dance of Genghis Khan. There's something about that era. I think it was when taboos were first being broken in dealing with that fairly recent trauma. Yeah, there was something about the painted bird. I read it when I was living in New Orleans, and it thoroughly fucked me up, and I thought, well, that would make a really great punk band name.
So my last question is just, what are you working on these days?
I'm writing different songs. I just wrote a couple weeks ago. I wrote music for an Itzik Manger poem, which I really like. Somebody's probably already set it to music, but it's Avraham Avinu Shaft das Messer. It's from the Chumash Lieder, or the Midrash Lieder.
Can you sing a few lines of it, or is it not at that point?
Yeah, no, sure. I've already performed it. So die Mutter surre in ihr weißer Häub sitzt auf der Prisbe vertracht. Ihr Nach ist wie ein junger Schwalb flattert über den Dach. Sie schmeichelt schon nach heutiger Zeit, sind Hoger ist er weg. Mit ihr Mamsruck Ishmael auf jenem schmolden Weg. Ai, 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 lulu, und ai, lulu. It's kind of a creepy little lullaby. And then Avram is sitting in the courtyard, like sharpening his knife.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining me to talk with Ingveb.
Sie haben eine große Kaffee.
It opened slowly. My father, he came in. I was 9 years old. And he stood so tall above me. His blue eyes, they were shining, and his voice was very cold. He said, I've had a vision. You know I'm strong and holy. I must do as I've been told. So we started up the mountain. I was running, he was walking, and his axe was made of gold.